We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, the 4th of April in the glorious future year of 2026. And I am coming to you by pre-recording. I'm only recording this about an hour ahead of showtime, simply so that I can go downtown for the Easter Vigil liturgy at the cathedral, the Frauenkirche, Dom zu unserer lieben Frau, if you care for the German there, which begins at 2100 local, not midnight, as would perhaps be traditional, but 2100 local, which is 1900 UTC, because they changed the clocks on us last week. UTC plus 1 wasn't so bad, but UTC plus 2, come on, man. Anyway, and the service, the Easter Vigil service, is a long and complicated one, which will probably not conclude until sometime after midnight. And somebody in the back is saying, "What's that, Publius? Are you a Roman Catholic?" And I will take a moment to remind you that the French positivist philosopher Auguste Comte had a desire to create something which would have the, how do I put this? Basically, he felt that the Catholic Church was the only thing in the world which had the requisite combination of satisfactory ritual experience with an adequate intellectual background. And so he tried to create an atheistic version of it called the Religion of Man. And as you can imagine, like most other 19th century new religious movements, other than maybe the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses, it kind of sank like a stone. I believe there may be a congregation or two still existing in Brazil for what that's worth. Anyhow, as I say, I have a desire to go down and participate in the service, even though I haven't been able, well, haven't been able is perhaps stretching the truth. I have failed to get to any of the other services this past week, starting with the Palm Sunday service, which was to have had a procession, weather permitting. Well, I got up, looked out the window, it was snowing. I said, no, that's clearly not weather permitting, and we're going to forget about that. Anyhow, so the big deal, the big thing that is happening is, of course, Artemis II. I hardly have to tell you, unless you've been living under a rock, that on April 1st at about 2230 UTC, NASA launched their first manned mission of the Space Launch System with the Orion capsule into an orbit around the Earth, and then that orbit has been raised into a high Earth orbit, and then there has been a translunar insertion maneuver. And they are preparing for their they are on their way to the moon. They're more than halfway there, right? And they are preparing for their lunar flyby maneuver. Interestingly, their early insertion burn was exact enough that NASA chose to cancel the first planned course correction maneuver. So that's pretty impressive. So yeah, this is the first time humans have been beyond low Earth orbit in over 50 years, since December of 1972. It's also the first time NASA has launched a NASA-owned spacecraft since 2011. And I want to be clear, all right. I was at the last space shuttle launch 15 years ago. I would have been very happy if it had been possible for me to be at this launch, but it did not happen like that. As some people were really surprised at the April 1st launch. Some even thought in the beginning that it might be some kind of April Fool's prank being pulled on them. And there are some aspects of it which have lent credence to that notion, such as apparently that they have two copies of Microsoft Outlook on board, neither of which is working right. That baffled me. Why would you put Microsoft Outlook into a spacecraft? Fortunately, it is apparently not on any kind of flight system computer that among the many sort of little extras that were packed, just like the tape recorders of the Apollo days, was a computer with a bunch of commercial software on it. And apparently somebody had an ambition to use Outlook as a way to, for its calendar function, to remind them of, you know, when you're supposed to eat your meals, when you're supposed to go to bed, when you're supposed to have a TV interview, that kind of thing. And apparently that did not work out very well. Not my problem. I definitely would not have gone that route, for sure. But I guess if you've been working in an office environment where Microsoft Office is ubiquitous, then there's something familiar and comforting about it, a little touch of home, as it were. Again, I find that bizarre and somewhat unsettling, but there you have it. So yeah, aside from that, what else is there to say? I mean, there's been some, someone said, what, you know, commentary is the word that I want, that boasting about, oh yes, they're going to actually get farther from the Earth than Apollo 13 did. Of course, what Apollo 13 did was an emergency maneuver. What Artemis 2 is supposed to be doing is not an emergency maneuver. But there are two sort of aspects to that. One of them is just where the moon is positioned with respect to the Earth, because, of course, there's perigee and apogee. And Apollo 13 happened to be out there at a period when it was near apogee. And the maneuver that they did took them in a fairly, well, used the lunar gravity to redirect them back to Earth, but it took them fairly far out. Well, the Artemis II is doing something somewhat different, but the important thing is that it's going over the poles, right? Because one of the things they want to do in the Artemis series, whether they're actually going to continue the series beyond this one flight is an interesting question, but one of their announced goals has been to have a long-duration stay. And that long-duration stay would be, as they keep saying anyway, at a polar site. And so you have to go into a polar orbit for that if you're going to do the same Apollo-style thing where you have a command module in orbit and then the lander descends to the surface and then comes back up to rendezvous with the command module again. Anyhow, but of course there are major differences, one being that the SLS is not intended to launch the lunar lander. Now, this is kind of bizarre because originally that was its whole function, Right. When we first heard about this whole scheme, it was Ares 1 and Ares 5 back, well, I mean, it was originally Bob Zubrin's idea, but when NASA adopted it under Mike Griffin about 2001, it was Ares 1 and Ares 5, and the whole point was that Ares 1 would launch the Command and Surface module into orbit, then Ares 5, with a much bigger load capacity, would launch the lunar lander into orbit, and also an escape stage, which would carry them into the translunar injection together, right? The lander would go up into orbit, the command module would go up into orbit, they'd rendezvous, then they'd boost out together. Why this now? Well, the answer simply comes in when you look at, if you looked very carefully at the SLS stack, you may have noticed that there wasn't really an upper stage that you could see. It seemed to be just the CSM bolted onto the top of the big orange tank. And yeah, there was a what they call the interim cryogenic upper stage up there, but it was so small it was easy to miss. In fact, it was so small that it could not boost the CSM into translunar orbit, only into a high Earth orbit, from which the service module propulsion system was required to actually get it out onto its translunar orbit. The whole thing is kind of cockamamie. They've got this great big booster, and they could have done the work with a booster half the size if they had a competent upper stage. As it is, their upper stage has, from what I can tell, one RL-10 engine. Now, the S4 stage, the original upper stage of the Saturn I, had six RL-10s, and that was deleted in favor of the S4B with a single J2 engine, which is much larger. Now, today's RL-10 has about twice the thrust of the 1960s RL-10s, but still, even two 1960s RL-10s is only a third of the original thrust of the S4 stage, which was found to be inadequate for lunar missions and replaced with a single J2. But there was this whole mess with the development of what they call a J2X, which is not the first time that designation has been used, and that's another problem, but an uprated J2 engine. There are still some Apollo J2s in storage, and again, when Mike Griffin first said, this is what we're going to do, it's going to be the cheap, quick, and fast new thing, right? They were going to use J2s pulled out of storage. They were going to use shuttle SRBs. They haven't done any of that. Right, all this stuff has been made special for purpose, aside from three of the four engines on the SLS core stage, which were refurbished space shuttle main engines that were then just dumped into the ocean. An ignominious end to their career, if you ask me. The fourth engine was a purpose-built RL-25 expendable SSME derivative. Crazy stuff. The only reason the SSME was ever created in the first place was with the idea that you could build a very high-performance engine and justify the cost by using it repeatedly. I don't know, the whole thing is very, very weird to me. And just to add an additional weird detail, I don't know if anybody else caught this, but I sure did. When they were launching, you might have noticed the solid rocket boosters. Now, I hate those damn things. I hate them with a passion. Because, as I've mentioned before, one of my first memories is of the loss of the Shuttle Challenger, which was essentially caused by those damnable segmented solid rocket boosters. And so, you know, when they launch a manned mission with those things, I basically can't breathe until SRBSEP. I hate those things. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is that with the special SRBs they were using, so NASA has, by executive directive, basically gone back to using the 1960s, what's known as the meatball logo, everybody's familiar with it, I think, with the Roman type lettering and the sort of chevron device and the little orbit, right? Everybody knows the classic NASA logo. the so-called worm logo that was adopted in the 70s has been eliminated, really, right? Except that Okay, what's going on here? Something bad has happened. I think I had a glitch in the recording there. I'm not sure what. But hopefully the file is okay. Hopefully this recording is working. Anyway, where was I? Oh yeah, so the worm logo, the single line spelling NASA, which was introduced in the 1970s and featured heavily in the early shuttle design work, and was the subject of a very elaborate design manual, which was then, a few years ago, somebody actually recreated the whole thing as a Kickstarter, which I found utterly fascinating. Anyway, but that worm logo was on the SRBs, along with a rather hard-to-see banner proclaiming the 250th anniversary of the United States, which I've heard people referring to as a semi-quincentennial, and I don't think that's the correct Latin term at all. I would refer to it as a sestercentennial, because Latin has a little shorthand for 2.5, which, oddly enough, the words it's made up of are half and three, semis tertius. Anyway, the coin known as a sesterce was so-called because it was 2.5 ases, where an as was a bronze coin. Anyway, never mind that. I was just baffled by this reappearance of the worm logo. Now again, some people were taken aback by the launch on April 1st. They weren't sure if this was real or some kind of a prank. April 1st was on the chart of launch opportunities that NASA issued back at the beginning of the year. And beyond that, we notice, you know, of course, they were going to launch back in February. Then they had a serious, serious problem with the upper stage, pushed it back to the VAB to tear down the upper stage and try and make it work. Then NASA finally got a new administrator, and his first press conference, which was in mid-March, one of the things that was announced was that they were going to try and launch in, quote, early April. Well, of course, the 1st of April is the earliest in April that you can possibly do this. So I was not surprised, but I can see how some people were confused. So yeah, that's sort of the thing about it. One person who did seem to be taken somewhat unawares, apparently, was the head honcho of the United States, who just dropped the mention, oh yeah, we're going to launch a mission to the moon today, in his typical 2 a.m. bathroom break social media frenzy. I mean, I don't begrudge the man for taking a potty break at 2 a.m., but seriously, can't he put the phone down? And the answer is no, he can't, because that's part of his pathological personality, I guess. And the rest of us just have to live with it, if we can in fact live with it. And it's questionable whether we can. One reason why he might have been taken unawares by this, you know, somebody said, well, surely if this was real, he would have been talking it up for the past 2 weeks or so. And the answer is, I'm afraid, no, because he has been head downward in consultations, if that's the word, with his real good buddy Hegseth, who, from all news reports, sounds as though he's spent the past couple of weeks like the guy in Alice's restaurant, jumping up and down and shouting, kill, 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 kill. I mean, news reports are saying that he has demanded the You know, no quarter, he says. In other words, if people surrender, we'll kill him. Non-combatants, we'll kill him. Women and children, we'll kill him. Because he believes, supposedly he's gotten into some real bad religion, which has led him to believe that he can tell who are the enemies of God, because he doesn't like them very much. That if he doesn't like someone, that person must be the enemy of God, and that therefore he has the God-given right to kill him and use any force necessary to do so, and not just kill, but annihilate. And while I am normally all for civilian control of the military, it is disappointing that the U.S. military establishment, disappointing in the extreme, that the U.S. military establishment has not said no, has not said we are not going to do this. And what's very concerning is there are rumors circulating that the U.S. diplomatic representation has been going around recently, attempting to build consensus, if that's a possible thing, for the use of nuclear weapons against Iran. This is deeply disturbing on a lot of levels. I mean, the first level, of course, being that it would be a horrifying crime to just get up in the morning, start a war against somebody, then decide you're going to use nuclear weapons against them, and murder millions of people by dropping an atom bomb on Tehran, which is a city of like 10 million people. It's a big city. And then we think about the geopolitical implications of this, and we realize, well, there's sort of two possibilities here, and neither of them is very pleasant. Because if we're talking about the United States using a nuclear weapon against Iran, what it basically comes down to is an agreement between the United States, Russia, and China, as the three powers having large stocks of nuclear weapons, to divide the world into spheres of interest, in which each sphere, right, the country controlling that sphere gets to threaten all the other countries with nuclear bombing of their cities if they don't do exactly as they're told. You know, even in the Cold War, right, the Soviet Union never threatened Poland, Bulgaria, Hungary, Romania with that. Tanks? Czechoslovakia. Tanks? Yes. Nuclear weapons used against cities? No. So that's a horrifying thought. And of course, the geopolitical implication is that the only countries able to maintain any kind of independence will be those which have nuclear weapons already. France, obviously, Britain to some extent, although it's dependent in that regard on the U.S. to a degree. India, Pakistan, North Korea. You're thinking, this sounds like a really great list. I really like the sound of this. And, you know, if that happens, right, then every country which can possibly make a nuclear weapon or something, or a nuclear explosive, to be frank, you don't necessarily have to have a deliverable weapon, is going to be scrambling to do exactly that. What's the list of countries that could do that very rapidly? Well, Canada, Japan, South Korea all possess the necessary competencies. It's not impossible that Australia might manage it. Germany used to have the capability, but whether Germany has that capability anymore is quite questionable. On the other hand, you know, Britain and France between them might be able to keep Western Europe largely self-governing. Sweden, which would probably be called on by Finland. You might see Sweden, Norway, and Finland kind of amalgamating into a single entity for military purposes there. Because that certainly does mesh with the rumors of a planned withdrawal from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization by the United States. None of this is pleasant to contemplate at all. And of course, the other, so yeah, you're talking about a complete breakdown of the nuclear non-proliferation treaty regime, even more so than it's already broken down. As I've said in the past many times, the nuclear weapons states have been in flagrant breach of it since the late 70s. But if we think about this, you know, the other possibility is the use of an Israeli nuclear weapon against Iran, and that, if anything, opens up an even more complex global political picture. I don't know what that means. But yeah, Brazil and Argentina could probably do it as a joint venture. South Africa did it once, but I don't know if they could do it again. I don't know. I'm seriously concerned about this. This is very bad, is what I'm saying. The people on this planet are crazy, and I want to leave. Aside from that, right, I was thinking the other day about the problem of financialization, because someone was very shocked, of course I've said this many times, but someone was very shocked to find out that, yeah, the whole thing about the AI bubble, it's not about Sam Altman or Jensen Huang having messianic delusions. They may, but that's not important, right? What's important is that the financiers saw their data center needs for their delusion as a way to keep the money flowing. That collateralized debt obligations based on data centers came after the 2008 financial panic. You know, you had collateralized debt obligations based on mortgages were a big chunk of the world paper economy. Not the physical economy, but the paper economy, which of course broke down with real consequences for a lot of people. Well, home mortgages were essentially replaced by data centers. And so the needs of the global financial sector is really what's kept huge sums of money flowing into data centers, which has what has bankrolled the surveillance capitalism economy. It's what has led to so much incredible waste of energy and resources and material in basically running huge amounts of really bad and inefficient computer code, much of it to do things you don't care about anyway. And they thought briefly that blockchains and Bitcoin and NFTs were going to be the way to keep that moving, but they just weren't able to generate the necessary momentum because too many people could see it was ludicrous. And so instead they settle on AI as the way to keep the money rolling in, keep those collateralized debt obligations being created. Well, now, for a variety of reasons, it looks as though a number of the data center construction projects now underway are going to stall out. They're not going to have the power they need. They're not going to have the computers they need because of everything. Well, basically because of arbitrary political actions, which have stopped a lot of global trade and made a lot of other things much more difficult, including, as I've said, the sudden destruction of a large chunk of the world's helium output capacity is going to result in a serious slowdown. And yeah, there are things that we've come to expect that are not being done because of shortages of RAM, shortages of SSDs, shortages of hard drives. And so, yeah, those collateralized debt obligations founded on data centers have a serious possibility of imploding. And what I was thinking about all this financialization is that, to a great extent, the financial markets and the things that go on in them are like the recirculating power fraction in a power plant. And so, ordinarily you want that to be as low as possible. That's one of the advantages of a steam power plant, is that the circulating pumps consume a tiny fraction of the total power output because water is dense. In a gas turbine plant, the compressors require something like 25% of the turbine power. In a steam plant, it's much smaller. You could build a fusion power plant today if you were willing to put up with a recirculating power fraction of 90%, and someone's trying to do that. But of course, what that means is you build a 500 megawatt power plant to get 50 megawatts out. Basically, financialization is something which tries to maximize the recirculating power fraction.